Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Well, I had this in my box of things, the possible lead stories, and then I watched the debates, or a part of them last night. And oh my goodness, Mayor Pete just lost my vote. Nice guy, usually says the right thing, very inspiring, great orator. But here's why. It was on the healthcare matter, as you might have guessed, and it was the idea that people who want to keep their insurance should be able to keep their insurance. That's like saying people who want to smoke should be able to keep smoking, or people who want to vape should be able to keep vaping, or whatever dangerous, unhealthy thing you want to substitute in there. Because we have to restructure the U.S. healthcare system, because the fundamental structure is fatally flawed. This article came out this week in the Journal of the American Medical Association. It's a very, very big deal. I actually found it in the weekly news magazine that is currently dated October 18th. So basically, we're not even there yet. And they thought it was so important, they highlighted it in the business section. So here's the executive summary. We spend a lot of money on healthcare. That's probably not a newsflash to you. We spend 17% of the gross national product on healthcare. It was 12% when I was first getting out of my medical training, and that would be in the early 90s. So now we're up to 17%. 25% of the cost of care, according to this recent analysis of data from the U.S. Institute of Medicine, and also an outfit called Beckworth and Hackbarth. I'm assuming that they are accountants. Anyway, here's the scoop. $760 to $935 billion. Hey, that's almost as much debt as Trump has run up in his term. That's really cool. We could save a lot of money if we eliminated some of the identified waste. So we'll just run through the list here of things that they identified and how much we're spending on them. Failure of care delivery, $102 to $165 billion. Failure of care coordination, and I have a few things to say about that, $27 to $78 billion. Over-treatment or low-value care, $75 billion to $100 billion. Pricing failure, $230 to $240 billion. Fraud and abuse, $58 to $83. I'll cut to the chase. The amount that we spend on administrative complexity is over 25, close to 30% of the whole. And that's WHOLE as well as whole, as in whole in the budget. You wonder why we spend so much more money than other countries on healthcare? Because we waste so much more money. And a lot of that administrative complexity goes away like poof if we move to a Medicare for All type system. And by that, I don't mean necessarily Medicare. We're going to have to tweak it a little bit to make it work. But I'm talking about some sort of single-payer system. And ultimately, to get from where we are to where we need to be, we're going to have to do that. Take a big, deep breath and take the leap. And let's start with why Mayor Pete is wrong. If we leave the insurance companies and the private insurers in place, we get to keep most of that $265 billion every day on administrative complexity, because that's being spent on the people with private health care insurance. And if his constituents are correct, and most people with insurance want to keep their insurance, then we get to keep $265 billion of wasted motion. And I don't think we can afford that. I could tell you that the overhead cost when I was running a insurance-based medical practice was one full-time equivalent employee per doctor. So we had five doctors. Guess what? We had five full-time people making a living wage in Santa Cruz or better, because many of them had been with us for many years. And we gave cost of living raises because, you know what? We got to pass people in the halls and eat lunch at the table next to them. And it's really hard not to give people cost of living wages when they're staring at you. So getting back to whether we were just cowardly or whether we were virtuous, this is not the point. So what do we need to save some of this administrative burden? This is a huge amount of money. Well, first of all, we need universal access to data for doctors and health systems. So talking about overtreatment or poor care coordination, we'll save a lot of money in those areas as well, because I might know what the endocrinologist actually did last month. I might know what tests they ordered. I might know that I don't need to duplicate what they did. I can't find that out right now. And that's ridiculous. The electronic medical records must be interoperable. That's not a requirement. That's ridiculous. If you are using one medical record, Epic, let's say, which is very big in this town, and you move to another town and they're using a different medical records, all, and I mean all of your data, including your lab forms and your test results and your surgery reports and your office notes and your vital signs, those should all be able to flow from one medical record to the other. Goodness gracious, you can download your bank account. You can download your Quicken credit card into your tax form. These things talk to each other for a reason. Why are we not facilitating this? Yeah, you can, if you spend enough time, enough FTE-funded time, you can maybe dig it out, but it is stunningly inefficient and stunningly difficult. And often doctors resort to faxing each other reports and then scanning those reports in as unsearchable image files, because that's the closest thing they can cobble together that at least resembles a medical record. It is a ridiculous, ridiculous situation that we find ourselves in. And while we're fixing healthcare, we might as well fix healthcare cybernetics. Another thing we need that doesn't have anything to do with the computers is pricing transparency and consistency. If you go to a restaurant in Des Moines, Iowa, and you go to a restaurant in New York City, let's call it a steak restaurant. Okay, the prices will probably be higher in New York City for a steak than in Des Moines, Iowa. But the prices will be right there on the menu. And you can decide whether you can afford the steak. You can price compare. You can go on Yelp or some other restaurant critique, and you can look at the menu prices and decide whether you can afford to go to that restaurant or that hospital or that doctor. How come we don't have that? Well, you know, under a national system, we would have that. And sure, the prices would depend upon the cost of living and the overhead costs locally. They might be higher in New York than in the Midwest. But that doesn't matter. The price would be a price, and you could figure out what it was. And if you were an insurance company, which these tend to be state-based, you'd be able to figure out what your cost and what your premium needed to be. Now, what if it's national? Well, then the insurance company goes away, and the cost is rolled into the taxes, and we get to argue about whether the people in high-earning states should be subsidizing the costs for people in lower-earning states. Guess what? We already answered that question. It's Medicare. And that's a federal program. It's a federal program, and they tweak the prices a little bit for reimbursement to the doctors at the federal end. And believe me, that's some kind of political negotiation. But it's a heck of a lot better. It's not perfect, away from that, but it is closer to a reality-based system and not a what-the-traffic-will-bear-based system. And the fix we need for Medicare, well, that's pretty simple. We need to make sure that people can't churn and do a lot of unnecessary procedures and a lot of unnecessary studies just because they happen to have a financial stake in the x-ray outfit across the street, or large multi-specialty groups like what we have in this town They've got an MRI. They've got an X-ray department. They can order the X-rays, and it's all good for them. I noticed that my patients who go to these large multi-specialty groups tend to get a lot more studies than I would normally order. And maybe that's just how the doctors feel is the right way to practice. It certainly is absolutely no systemic deterrent for them to do that. So we can't sign a blank check. And we do need criteria, and that's not that hard. There are places in the country that use Medicare very efficiently. We know who they are, and Medicare knows who they are. They've got all the data they need to figure out who's a good actor and benchmark the good actors and say, here's what the standards are. This is what we'll pay for. Let's give you some overhead if you need something more. If you want more, then you're going to have to go through a cumbersome bureaucratic process to get it. And if it's really necessary, you will. And if it's not, then you won't. If we've got to balance the incentives. And right now we have a completely broken at every level of market theory and economics you can possibly imagine. And no, I'm sorry. I know it's politically easier to let people keep their insurance that they're happy with, but those people are living in a fool's paradise. And they're only happy with it because the rubber hasn't hit the road for them. And you know, as Elizabeth Warren said last night, it's a major cause of bankruptcy. And they've made the bankruptcy under Bush the First. They made it very hard to go into bankruptcy for medical costs. So you know what? Eventually, those insurance companies, all that unnecessary administrative service of people, yeah, they are getting paid. And it's coming out of people's hides. Not fair, not right, needs to be fixed. Sorry, but this can't be done by half measures. This has to be one big, giant gulp. And yeah, it'll be ugly for a few years while we figure it out. Maybe we can phase it in, but we've got to get this $250 billion toilet that we're flushing money into, you know, we've got to close that down. There are a lot of other things that I could talk about. I'll mention the surprise billing and the hidden costs. We talked about that about a month ago, but we could come back to it if someone's interested. And that's where you go to a hospital. The hospital takes your insurance, but it turns out the anesthesiologist who covered your emergency surgery doesn't take your insurance, and you get stuck with a really high non-discounted, non-negotiated bill because you don't have any market leverage because that person isn't signed up with your insurance. That's another thing that goes away under any rational healthcare system. And fixing it, yeah, it's in Congress right now. Don't hold your breath. Plus, it's a piecemeal patch that doesn't get to the root of the problem. Let's go to our first email. This one from Patricia in Santa Cruz. Johnson's Baby Shampoo. Your segment on baby shampoo for eye dryness caught my attention. Years ago, a hairdresser warned me about baby shampoo and said the only reason it doesn't sting is because it has some sort of anesthetic in it. I don't know if this is still true. I did read the other day that they've reconstituted their formula to no longer contain formaldehyde. We're talking about Johnson's & Johnson's. But I also looked it up on the Environmental Working Group websites, and there are many baby shampoos that are a lot safer. She sent me a link, which I will post, but I want to comment on the things that didn't look so good to Pat. I didn't think they looked so bad to me. And there's an old saying in medicine, and it's the dose makes the poison. So there are certain things that do not kill you until you get to the lethal dose. They, in fact, may actually make you stronger at lower doses. A lot of pharmaceuticals fall into this category. When it comes to the components in baby shampoo, let me give you the context of Pat's comment. I was talking about treating blepharitis, which is an infection on the base of the eyelashes. And I said to take a little bit of baby shampoo and put it on a wet washcloth and scrub along the eyelashes a couple of times a day. And that would usually take care of the problem. And for maintenance, someone may need to do an eyelash scrub a couple of times a week to keep it from coming back. And I felt like that's a pretty low-level exposure to any chemical. And so, and also to remember that the Environmental Working Group was looking at doses for babies. Babies weigh, you know, somewhere between 10 to 20 pounds. And at that age and at that size, a milligram means a lot more than when you weigh 100 pounds. So your body is also more mature as an adult and you're able to break down compounds. So I honestly am not worried about whatever kind of baby shampoo. If you want to get the expensive stuff, it's all natural, go use, support those companies because I want them to exist. If you're on a budget and you want to buy the tiny little travel package of Johnson & Johnson's for your blepharitis because it'll last you about 3 years, I'm also down with that. Our next email is from David, and he did not give a location. He wants my opinion on longevity. And let me see, I had a bunch of he sent me a link, and then from that link, I kind of took it away. So the link was about taking metformin, NMN, which is nicotinamide mononucleotide, together. And this was a interview with by someone named Brian Wong about David Sinclair. This is a guy who is a multimillionaire. He's one of those multimillionaire scientists. He's actually a professor of genetics at Harvard Medical School. And he discovered some anti-aging effects of resveratrol in some genes called the sirtuins and put together a company called Sirtris that was weaponizing resveratrol as a longevity anti-cancer and anti-diabetes drug. And they developed this product, and then in 2013, they sold out to GlaxoSmithKline for $720 million. That was presumably a profit for Dr. Sinclair. And he's gone on to fund several biotechnology companies and has his own journal called Aging. So basically, this is his thing. He was interviewed by this fellow and gave his secrets to his anti-aging regimen. So he is testing nicotinamide mononucleotide. If you look up nicotinamide riboside, you'll find a lot of information, a lot of product out there. He describes it as a fuel for sirtuins, more about sirtuins in a minute. It increases levels of NAD, which is good. NAD goes down as we age. It's critical for supplying energy to a great majority of the biochemical processes that keep our body running. So it's kind of like an electricity brownout when you don't have enough of it. He also, although he's not diabetic, takes a gram of metformin once a day. And he takes a half a gram, that's 500 milligrams of resveratrol. And that's actually one of the problems with resveratrol is that it's really expensive. And because he has a company and he's a millionaire, he can afford to take half a gram of resveratrol. Most of the commercial resveratrol you see out there is 50 milligrams. A bottle will run you, 30 of those will run you maybe somewhere between 30 and 40 bucks. And you'd have to take, 10 bottles a month. You'd have to go through 10 bottles a month to get the kind of doses we're talking about, a bottle every 3 days. So you're talking about $500 for your life prolongation. And you know, most of us can't quite afford that. He also does some other things, which I think are good. He takes a gram of metformin once a day. We'll start with that. He also does a very old traditional process. He heats himself in a hot tub and then jumps into a cold bath or cold shower. This is kind of like the Swedish and Nordic sauna and then jump into the snow puddle. It's probably really good for you. It certainly is a stressor, like I was talking about. What does not kill you makes you stronger. This fits into that category. It is a system stressor, but it stresses the system in a way that allows you to then tolerate extreme swerves in your physiology, which is good because if you get a high fever, that's an extreme swerve and your body's already adapted to that. On to the metformin. The metformin is a drug which acts on the liver. It makes the liver more sensitive to insulin. And insulin resistance, if we get time this program, we'll talk a little bit perhaps about fatty liver disease, or we may kick that down to a week or so, but we'll get there. The liver, when you have insulin resistance, there's a lot of fat floating around in your bloodstream, and the liver has to put it somewhere, so it stuffs it into the liver, and you'll start to see fatty deposits in the liver. Not good. Impairs liver function, which impairs detoxification. So then you're more vulnerable to all of the crap in our environment. So you start hitting your mitochondria because you can't get rid of the garbage. Then the mitochondria start dying down or reducing. And if you're a typical sedentary adult, you're not doing anything to stimulate the mitochondria. So you start losing mitochondria, your muscles get weak, and your brain gets weak. So the article that I had was about NAD as riboside. This is molecularly virtually identical to the mononucleotide that the person who emailed David asked about, and it enhances oxidative metabolism. In other words, it makes your mitochondria work better. It regulates the sirtuins, and we'll come back to those. It increases NAD bioavailability, so it protects against diabetes and metabolic disease, including fatty liver. In yeast, when you play with the sirtuins, you increase the lifespan in yeast, and there are some animal studies that show that messing with the sirtuin genes and upregulating them can be beneficial in animals with animal models of diabetes. We do not have data on humans that shows any of the kind. That could be because of dosing. It could be because humans aren't lab rats. It could be because humans' diets are so variable that that muddies the effect of giving a nutrient like this, because a lot of what we eat is enriched with B vitamins, which would include a variation of nicotinamide called niacin. So we may already be doing all of the supplementation we can in humans, and so there's no additional benefit to this. Lots of questions in the air, but I want to talk about the sirtuins, because the sirtuins are a gene. It's a protein, actually, that's encoded, I should say, by a gene called SIRT. And the SIRT1 gene is a deacetylase. That means that it contributes to protein regulation. And it's been known to regulate epigenetic gene silencing. And anyone who's been a regular listener knows that there are two ways that genes are controlled. And the environment is the master controller. And that environment also includes what you eat, but also your stress, the pollution you encounter, your behavior in terms of sleep and exercise. The environment runs the genes. It determines what genes get turned on, what genes get turned off. If you've got identical twins and you send one up into space, we now know that that's a substantially different environment. I guess we could have figured that out. The amount of changes in terms of deacetylation and methylation, which occurred during that experiment, was astonishing. And also interesting was to watch the genes revert back to being more to type. The SIRT ones were definitely part of the genes that were influenced by this shift. When you have high insulin resistance in a cell, the sirtuin gene is turned off. So when you use these riboside products, you have the potential to turn that gene back on. Other things that turn that gene on really well and increase longevity without a doubt, and this is one of the pivot points in that research, is eating less, fasting, or a calorie-restricted diet. So if you calorie-restrict without nutrient-restricting, which means you have to take supplements, and you do that with lab animals, you can increase their lifespan. This goes all the way up to monkeys, so it's probably true in humans as well. Probably accounts for why there's such a large fasting and longevity culture in Asia. But fasting definitely helps you live longer if you're a mammal. That's pretty clear. The problem is humans don't like to fast, and we're walking around in a candy store constantly in our society. So getting humans to fast, not so easy. That's where the resveratrol came from. If you give enough of it, you turn on the SIRT1 gene, just as fasting does. But that's also where some of the cold stress research, like the idea of doing a sauna and then jumping into a cold bath, comes in. That type of environmental shift also tends to demethylate or activate the CERT genes, which then go on to deactivate a lot of really important genes, including one that's critical in cancer. Now, yeasts don't get cancer, and so far the cancer data in animals is not persuasive. But the other thing the CERT1 genes do is they reduce inflammation. It inhibits the production of the master turner-oner of inflammatory genes. So when you get an infection, NF-kappa-B goes into the nucleus of the cell, and it turns on all the inflammatory genes, all the genes that call the white cells, all the sirens, all the alarms, all of the inflammatory genes like the COX-1 and the COX-2, they all get turned on by NF-kappa-B. And guess what some of the best down regulators for NF-kappa-B are? Things that prevent it from getting to the nucleus. Well, you probably wouldn't be surprised that one of them is fish oil, and that another one of them is curcumin, and another one of them is ECGC, the active ingredient in green tea. So, or one of them, green tea has lots of active ingredients. So, it's very interesting biochemistry, and if I was going to give you some advice, I would say if you're overweight, taking a little metformin every day, small dose, not a full dose, not a bad idea. Might help you lose weight. Certainly will help protect you from fatty liver. Certainly could be beneficial from a longevity standpoint. Very low risk for damage, except stop taking it if you get an infection, and take a B vitamin if you're taking metformin. And that's true for all of my patients out there, or my radio patients. If you're taking metformin, you should be taking a B vitamin as well, because it does interfere with some of the B vitamins. Go now to a recent paper published. It was in JAMA Internal Medicine, and I'll post the link to this because I think a lot of people maybe want to look at this. I want to start by saying that this is about the first sexual experience. This is not about rape, and that's an important distinction to make. I've been thinking a lot about rape and sexual violence and other types of violence with reference to children. I want to remind people that I have a art show over at the Restore, which is 719 Swift Street in Santa Cruz. They're open from 9 to 6 except Sunday, so if you are in that neck of the woods, please stop by and take a look. It's a quick show. Please leave feedback. There is a place to do that. I want to emphasize that if you have a history of childhood sexual abuse yourself, this may pull some levers, but I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, because I think it also tells people that they're not alone. And what the research that I talk about at that show says is that this is stunningly common, unfortunately, and so is coercion. 1 in 6 United States girls or women were forced into their first experience of sex, either physically or through other kinds of pressure. This comes from responses of 13,000 women between 18 and 44 who answered an anonymous survey put out by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. Forced was defined in the study as if this was not voluntary. About half of that 1 in 16, so that would be 1 in 32 of U.S. women by this sample, were held down. A quarter were physically harmed, and a quarter were physically threatened. There's overlap, obviously, between those two groups. About half report being verbally pressured, such as, the relationship would end unless you have sex. And a fifth of them said they had been given alcohol or drugs. Even when there was no physical coercion, the average age of a woman forced into sex was 15, and the average age of the man doing the forcing was 27. So there's a huge power imbalance here. And I think in the wake of Epstein and the childhood sexual abuse videotape market that exists on dark social media now, we have to say that this is a horrendous social issue that needs to be addressed. Women who first had sex voluntarily, the average age for women was 17 with a 21-year-old partner. 17, yeah, that sounds about when you're old enough. 15 with a 27-year-old partner, yeah, that doesn't sound right to me. And that's why there are laws against it, and there should be. But unfortunately, laws aren't enough. We need to really be vigilant, and we need to really teach our women and our girls, especially our girls, what is correct, what are some strategies. I think that's gotten lost. When I was younger, growing up in the 60s and 70s, we had all sorts of girl lore. And I'm remembering Christine Blasey Ford's testimony and that wear a bathing suit under your jeans thing. That's girl lore about how not to be forced into having sex, because we all knew that it was a given that somebody was going to try that. I don't know if girls know that now. I don't know if they protect themselves as well. And I certainly think that that has to be part of sex education. And that whole backlash that I saw on some of the podcasts that I listened to about, you know, stopping and asking the woman, is it okay if I do this? Is it okay if I do this? You know, maybe that's not such a bad idea, guys. You could probably make it sound sexy if you tried. Work on that. And maybe you could even add to the experience. Our next story is about an unexpected action of your skeleton. So I did not know this, and I found it really interesting. But when you are in a sudden threat, your heart speeds up, your breathing rate increases, your blood pressure goes up. We know all of that. That's called the fight or flight response. Well, it turns out that the fight or flight response is also happening in the bones. And in the bones, there is a hormone being released called osteocalcin. So blood levels of osteocalcin rise very quickly in people when they're stressed. And the bones, the osteocalcin helps the muscles burn fuel during exercise. They also did some studies in mice, and they showed that it makes aging muscles more useful. And of course, because it's America, they're thinking about how can we develop drugs. But I went and looked up osteocalcin, and I found that it increases insulin levels. That would work for fight or flight response. It increases insulin sensitivity. So now the insulin's going to open a lot of doors, and a lot of glucose is going to rush in and help fuel those muscles. It increases testosterone, which I found to be a sort of a surprise. And of course, we've used osteocalcin, and where I know about it is just that we use it as a marker in bone studies. So if you, for example, are building new bone because you have a broken bone, you can see a rise in osteocalcin. We also know, for example, that the bisphosphonates, the most commonly used osteoporosis fracture prevention drug, do not raise osteocalcin. They do not help with the formation of new bone. But terepeptoride, which is a drug called Forteo, given by injection, and one of hard to get for patients because it's expensive, but it's one of my favorite drugs for someone who's had multiple osteoporotic fractures. I generally have to put them on a bisphosphonate and have that fail due to lack of patient tolerance before I can get them on that drug. And it does require that you self-inject, but it is an extremely effective way of rebuilding bone, not just slowing down the breakdown of bone, but actually goosing the osteoblasts, the bone building cells. And I think that just makes a lot more sense. But like I said, it's expensive, so we probably aren't going to be seeing large quantities of it anytime soon. So I'm going to launch into a deep dive, and this is aimed at all of you people who are out there doing paleo, Atkins, or high-protein keto. And I want to talk to you about a little thing called urea. So you know when you get a bunch of bird poo on your car and you ignore it? I never do that anymore because it pits the finish. It's a very strong acid called uric acid, and it's the same stuff that comes off of protein when you digest it. It's the nitrogen. And effectively what happens is we make ammonia, and then we turn, which is very toxic, as you may or may be aware, we actually make ammonia in our own bodies. And then through a series of enzymatic steps called the urea cycle, we convert this very toxic ammonia into urea. It turns out that mutations in urea cycle are not that unusual. So let me backtrack a moment. I want to explain inborn errors of metabolism and how I learned it back in the day. Inborn errors of metabolism are where you have an enzyme that doesn't work properly. And it's a disease when you're born with two bad copies of these inborn error of metabolism. And most of the ones that I learned about were the ones that caused really severe symptoms in childhood. So the way you would figure these out would be, for example, here's one called citrullinemia type 1. The babies would get very high ammonia because they couldn't process protein. They'd get sleepy. They'd start vomiting. They'd get increased intracranial pressure. And it occurs, two copies of that gene occurs in about one in every 50,000 births. So that's not that common, but you have to figure that if two copies are that frequent, then one copy is more frequent. And there are a lot of people walking around as carriers of this. And it's just like sickle cell or anything else. If you marry somebody who's got the same deficiency, you could get really big problems. Here's one. Ornithine carbamylase deficiency. This is one in every 14,000 live births. That probably means that about one in 1,000 people are walking around with a heterozygous mutation. So let's talk about what heterozygous was. I was taught back there in medical school that one good copy was enough, but that was a flaw in our imagination. We weren't thinking functionally. We were thinking about, is it a disease with, you know, identifiable symptoms and identifiable lab tests? And if it wasn't, then it wasn't a disease. One good copy of the gene is enough not to get to the disease. It's enough not to die. But it's not necessarily enough to function well, and particularly when you throw in extreme conditions. And when we eat a very high protein diet, or we are throwing in some extreme conditions. And there are a number of other places in the methylation pathway and the transsulfuration pathway and all these other enzymatic things. It just looks like the world's most complicated software flowchart. It's hard to even imagine. So here's my advice. If there is any, if you've had your 23andMe done, then go ahead and get a list of the urea cycle disorder genes. And that's not hard to find. You can easily look that up on the internet. And then just look and see if you have those mutations. And you'll have to go through. It's tedious. You can go through a site called Prometheace and dump that in. And if you have enough medical knowledge, you can, and you watch the video, you can probably find whether you have urea cycle issues. The other thing you could just do is check your ammonia level. So if you're going to go on one of these diets, bulletproof or any of that stuff, you want to check your ammonia levels before you start the diet if you can, but certainly making sure that your ammonia levels stay below the halfway mark on the normal range. If they're going up, you want to drink more water. And if they're still going up and you're peeing like the proverbial racehorse, then you want to actually back down on this diet. It's dangerous for your brain and your health. want to take a moment and do a quick story. This one about malaria. There's a guy in a guy named Brian Gita who grew up in Uganda, and he became a computer person, went to the university, and he remembered all those people in his village with malaria. He says he had malaria every year and got treated. He's invented a device. It looks just like that oxygen monitor, and it's in fact based on the technology of the oxygen monitor. Turns out that when you have malaria, the disease causes a change in the chemical composition of the red blood cells and their physical composition as well, because they've got plasmodium growing in them. So it creates a change in the bloodstream. And using light scattering and magnetism and shining a light beam through the finger, they could detect malaria with about 90% accuracy at the level of the village. So they're working on more iterations for this. But this is an amazing new technology, and it makes you wonder exactly how many other chemical changes in the blood could we figure out if we did that. And I'm just hoping to see more entrepreneurs and people in emerging nations take what they're learning on the internet and at their universities and really think outside the box and develop things where they aren't going to be just bought up and squashed by large companies. They'll have something out there on the market being distributed before big industry knows what hit them, and I'm looking forward to that. We're going to our first caller of the evening, and that is Amy with joint pain. How are you?
I'm fine. Well, I'm sort of fine. So at night, while at bedtime, when I sleep, my joints ache like crazy. I wake up times a night, you know, with super, super achy in my hips and my shoulders, my wrists, my ankles. Now, I broke my foot and my ankle about 2.5 months ago, and it's healing well, but since then, this seems to have gotten worse. And then during the day, I'll get up in the morning and I'll take a hot shower and I'll start to feel better. And then during the day, I'll be fine. And it's really just after that, you know, that quiet rest where you're not moving. You know, I'll wake up in the morning and my feet feel like stumps. I mean, it's really hard to walk. And so
how old are you, Amy?
Have any ideas?
How old are you, Amy?
I'm 60.
So, and you said you've had this joint pain for a while. Can you remember how long?
Yeah. Oh, often, you know, it seems like it's gotten worse in the last year or so. And like I said, I broke my foot.
Yeah, yeah. And that could be a factor.
2.5 months ago.
Was that treated surgically or conservatively with a cast?
No, it was just with a removable cast.
All right. And so obviously your activity changed, and and of course the pain from a broken bone can affect your sleep, but it sounds like it's just the joints, right? The muscles and the tendons are okay?
Well, you know, it seems like it's the joints. I mean, it's my hips, it's my shoulders, it's my wrists.
Redness and swelling?
And I actually have...
Go ahead, I'm sorry. I said...
Well,
is there...
and I have healed from my foot and the ankle, you know, I'm back to kind of, except for hiking, I feel like I can't hike, but, and I started swimming. I'm very active. I swam even when I had my broken foot. That was okay. You know, swim very carefully.
Right. And you're not seeing any redness and swelling on the joints and over, nothing like
all.
That. No physical changes that you can spot. Knees don't look swollen.
Not at all.
All right. So, you know, it sounds like something's upregulated your inflammation. I'm intrigued with the fact that it's focusing on the joints. So do you happen to know what your vitamin D level is?
Last time I had it checked, it was pretty good.
Okay.
I actually get, as I swim, you know, as I am a swimmer, I do get pretty good even natural vitamin D.
Right, right, which
but
is
I
the best
had
kind.
It, I haven't, yeah, yeah, but... So I don't think my vitamin D is low.
Okay. And so the first place to look here is hidden causes of inflammation that are causing this. And I would start with a simple test called a high sensitivity C-reactive protein. And this is an inflammatory marker. And you're basically just going fishing. So you want to know, does the person have insulin resistance? And you're low risk for that, it sounds like. But nevertheless, you know, I would check a hemoglobin A1C or a fasting glucose. Maybe you've already had those tests recently. But I'd look for also lipids, and I'd look for elevated triglycerides, because a person that's one of the better tests for figuring out that a person's insulin levels are starting to go up. Because you can have a normal fasting blood sugar and have a high blood sugar after meals, and the insulin, you'll start to get insulin resistant. Insulin resistance will actually create a climate of pro-inflammation. So just like when PG&E turned off the power because it's like, well, it's really windy and it's kind of hot and dry, that's the pro-inflammatory condition, and then it doesn't take much to strike a match. So you may have that. Let me ask, are you a very flexible person? Have you always been like really good at yoga and, you know, touching the floor and all of that? So you want to look for insulin resistance. You want to look at inflammatory markers. You want to think about whether or not your microbiome got disrupted through antibiotic use. And you're kind of sniffing around to see what could be increasing my inflammation. In terms of therapeutic measures that you could take right now after you get those blood tests, what we want you to do is take a look at your diet, take a look at what may have shifted in the last few months from when this got worse, and see if you can identify any triggers. So I'm going to give you a moment to do that. Let's give you some therapeutics to try. If you can't come up with anything that looks like a trigger, and I do want you to also get a test for ANA, which is an ANA. It's a screening for autoimmune disease. You're a little old at 60 to get autoimmune disease, but you're female, and that would be the one thing I would certainly not want to miss, would be a low-grade autoimmune disease. And if that were the situation, then it probably means that something has happened, and there is some hidden infection, possibly in your gut, possibly in your sinuses, that is triggering your immune system and causing it to aggress against your joints. So hsCRP, ANA, and a hemoglobin A1C, those are your tests to get. And then in terms of therapeutics, fish oil, curcumin are really, really excellent agents. And I also will have people use cat's claw, which is uña de gato. These three things all, as I said before earlier in the program, they drop NF-kappa B. So doses, maybe 2,000 to 4,000 milligrams of fish oil, 500 to 700 milligrams of curcumin, and that's going to be the expensive one, because if you can do this with turmeric, but you basically have to figure out how to eat about a tablespoon of turmeric a day. And I'm sorry, 5 grams, teaspoon of turmeric a day, and about an eighth to a tenth of a teaspoon of black pepper. And if you can figure out how to eat that, that will give you enough curcumin. But most of us resort to supplements after the first week or so. It's very, very hard to stick with.
Mm-hmm. Well, I already take fish oil and curcumin.
Yes.
But not the cat's claw.
Yeah, so start.
I don't know if I take that.
Take about 250 twice a day and boot your doses and see if that helps, and get those tests, because there could be some, this could be kind of the canary in the coal mine for something physiologic that's going on. When you have generalized joint inflammation at night, you're swelling in there is what's going on. And when you're moving around, the swelling goes away. And that's why you can work it out in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all I've got for you right now.
Okay. Well, thank you. I'll get those tests, and I really appreciate your help.
Thank you. All right. So we're going to just do a quick story because we're running out of time. And I'll just stop. We've been talking about all of this stuff around twins and epigenetics. And that's really those methylations and acetylations and copy number variations and all this other stuff that's going on in the cells. This is actually a true fact. twins are only ever identical immediately after that first cell division. After the second cell division, when each twin has two cells, they start to change. Transcription errors. Every time your cells divide, there are errors. And not all of those errors get caught, but most of them are trivial. But these trivial mutations accumulate. And also, anything that actually grows and develops, fingertips, irises, ears, your heart, the pattern of veins in your palm, all of these things are substantially different because these grew. They had a basic kind of instruction for how to grow, but they grow, they don't grow like following a blueprint. They actually grow the way that you would drive somewhere. You're giving directions, but you're going to stop at a stoplight. You're going to stop for a pedestrian. It's going to take slightly different amounts of time for you to get where you're going. And in the case of the dietary and behavioral differences, even in the womb, one twin's likely to have a more advantageous access to the blood supply than the other. One twin's going to have the other twin's foot in its face. Those sorts of things actually modify the variation such that by the time identical twins are born, you can tell them apart with very simple instrumentations, and they do not have identical fingerprints or palm blood vessel patterns or irises. So we are all of us truly unique, and that's kind of a neat thought to leave you with. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.